good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 612 of Unwelcome Guests. From Conquistadors to Opium Wars. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're continuing our look at the untold history of debt and money. Now, in a moment, we're going to resume reading about debt in the Middle Ages. We're going to finish that chapter and start on the next one with some grisly details about the conquistadors. And for a change of pace, we're going to be hearing Frank Sinello speaking about the Opium Wars. That's towards the end of our first hour. Now, let's return to Chapter 10 of David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Kings effectively treated debts owed to Jews as ultimately owed to themselves, even setting up a branch of the treasury, the exchequer of the Jews, to manage them. This was, of course, much in keeping with the popular English impression of their kings as themselves a group of rapacious Norman foreigners. But it also gave the kings the opportunity to periodically play the populist card, dramatically snubbing or humiliating their Jewish financiers, turning a blind eye or even encouraging pogroms by townsfolk who chose to take the exception of St. Ambrose literally and treat moneylenders as enemies of Christ who could be murdered in cold blood. Particularly gruesome massacres occurred in Norwich in 1144 AD and in France in Blois in 1171. Before long, as Norman Cohn put it, what had once been a flourishing Jewish culture had turned into a terrorized society locked in perpetual warfare with the greater society around it. One mustn't exaggerate the Jewish role in lending. Most Jews had nothing to do with the business, and those who did were typically bit players, making minor loans of grain or cloth for return in kind. Others weren't even really Jews. Already in the 1190s, preachers were complaining about lords who would work hand in glove with Christian moneylenders, claiming they were our Jews, and thus under their special protection. By the 1100s, most Jewish moneylenders had long since been displaced by Lombards from northern Italy and Caorsins from the French town of Cahors, who established themselves across Western Europe and became notorious rural usurers. The rise of rural usury was itself a sign of a growing free peasantry. There had been no point in making loans to serfs since they had nothing to repossess. It accompanied the rise of commercial farming, urban craft guilds, and the commercial revolution of the High Middle Ages, all of which finally brought Western Europe to a level of economic activity comparable to that long since considered normal in other parts of the world. The Church quickly came under considerable popular pressure to do something about the problem, and at first it did try to tighten the clamps. Existing loopholes in the usury laws were systematically closed, particularly the use of mortgages. These latter began as an expedient. As in medieval Islam, those determined to dodge the law could simply present the money, claim to be buying the debtor's house or field, and then rent it back to the debtor until the principal was repaid. In the case of a mortgage, the house was in theory not even purchased, but pledged as security, but any income from it accrued to the lender. In the 11th century, this became a favourite trick of monasteries. In 1148, it was made illegal. Henceforth, all income was to be subtracted from the principal. Similarly, in 1187, merchants were forbidden to charge higher prices when selling on credit, the Church thereby going much further than any school of Islamic law ever had. In 1179, usury was made a mortal sin, and usurers were excommunicated and denied Christian burial. Before long, new orders of itinerant friars like the Franciscans and Dominicans organized preaching campaigns,
travelling town to town, village to village, threatening moneylenders with the loss of their eternal souls if they didn't make restitution to their victims. All of this was echoed by a heady intellectual debate in the newly founded universities, not so much as to whether usury was sinful and illegal, but precisely why. Some argued that it was theft of another's material possessions, others that it constituted a theft of time, charging others for something that belonged only to God. Some held that it embodied the sin of sloth, since, like the Confucians, Catholic thinkers usually held that a merchant's profit could only be justified as payment for his labour, i.e. transporting goods to wherever they were needed, whereas interest accrued even if the lender did nothing at all. Soon, the rediscovery of Aristotle, who returned in Arabic translation, and the influence of Muslim sources like Ghazali and Ibn Sina added new elements, that treating money as an end in itself defied its true purpose, that charging interest was unnatural, in that it treated mere metal as if it were a living thing that could breed or bear fruit. But, as the church authorities soon discovered, when one starts something like this, it's very hard to keep a lid on it. Soon, new popular religious movements were appearing everywhere, and many took up the same direction so many had in late antiquity, not only challenging commerce, but questioning the very legitimacy of private property. Most were labelled heresies and violently suppressed, but many of the same arguments were taken up amongst the mendicant orders themselves. By the 13th century, the great intellectual debate was between the Franciscans and the Dominicans over apostolic poverty, basically over whether Christianity could be reconciled with property of any sort. At the same time, the revival of Roman law, which, as we've seen, began from the assumption of absolute private property, put new intellectual weapons in the hands of those who wished to argue that, at least in the case of commercial loans, usury laws should be relaxed. The great discovery in this case was the notion of interès, which is where our word interest originally comes from, a compensation for loss suffered because of late payment. The argument soon became that if a merchant made a commercial loan, even for some minimal period, say a month, it was not usurious for him to charge a percentage for each month afterward. Since this was a penalty, not rental for the money, it was justified as compensation for the profit he would have made had he placed it in some profitable investment, as any merchant would ordinarily be expected to do. The reader may be wondering how it could have been possible for the usury laws to move in two opposite directions simultaneously. The answer would seem to be that politically, the situation in Western Europe was remarkably chaotic. Most kings were weak, their holdings fractured and uncertain. The continent was a checkerboard of baronies, principalities, urban communes, manors, and church estates. Jurisdictions were constantly being renegotiated, usually by war. Merchant capitalism of the sort long familiar in the Muslim Near West only really managed to establish itself quite late compared to the situation in the rest of the medieval world, when merchant capitalists managed to secure a political foothold in the independent city-states of northern Italy, most famously Venice, Florence, Genoa, and Milan, followed by the German cities of the Hanseatic League. Italian bankers ultimately managed to free themselves from the threat of expropriation by themselves taking over governments, and by doing so, acquiring their own court systems, capable of enforcing contracts, and even more critically, their own armies. What jumps out in comparison with the Muslim world are these links of finance, trade, and violence. Whereas Persian and Arab thinkers assumed that the market emerged as an extension of mutual aid, Christians never completely overcame the suspicion that commerce was really an extension of usury, a form of fraud only truly legitimate when directed against one's mortal enemies. Debt was, indeed, sin, on the part of both parties to the transaction. Sin was essential to the nature of the market. Competition was usually non-violent warfare. There was a reason why, as I've already observed, the words for truck and barter, in almost all European languages, were derived from the same terms meaning swindle, bamboozle, or deceive. Some disdained commerce for that reason. Others embraced it. Few would have denied that the connection was there. One need only examine the way that Islamic credit instruments, or for that matter, the Islamic ideal of the merchant adventurer, were eventually adopted, to see just how intimate this connection really was. It is often held that the first pioneers of modern banking were the military order of the Knights of the Temple of Solomon, commonly known as the Knights Templar. A fighting order of the monks, they played a key role in financing the Crusades. Through the Templars, a lord in southern France might take out a mortgage on one of his tenements and receive a draft, a bill of exchange, modelled on the Muslim suftaja, but written in a secret code, redeemable for cash from the temple in Jerusalem. In other words, Christians appear to have first adopted Islamic financial techniques to finance attacks against Islam. The Templars lasted from 1118 to 1307, but they finally went the way of so many medieval trading minorities. King Philip IV, deep in debt to the order, turned on them, accusing them of unspeakable crimes. Their leaders were tortured and ultimately killed, and their wealth was expropriated. Much of the problem was that they lacked a powerful home base. Italian banking houses, such as the Bardi, Peruzzi, and Medici, did much better. In banking history, the Italians are most famous for their complex joint stock organization and for spearheading the use of Islamic-style bills of exchange. At first, these were simple enough, basically just a form of long-distance money changing. A merchant could present a certain amount in florins to a banker in Italy, then receive a notarized bill registering the equivalent in the international money of account, Carolingian deniers, due in, say, 3 months' time, and then, after it came due, either he or his agent could cash it for an equivalent amount of local currency in the champagne fairs, which were both the great yearly commercial emporia and great financial clearing houses of the European High Middle Ages. But they quickly morphed into a plethora of new, creative forms, mainly a way of navigating, or even profiting from, the endlessly complicated European currency situation. Most of the capital for these banking enterprises derived from the Mediterranean trade in Indian Ocean spices and Eastern luxuries. Yet, unlike the Indian Ocean, the Mediterranean was a constant war zone. Venetian galleys doubled as both merchant vessels and warships, replete with cannon and marines, and the differences between trade, crusade, and piracy often depended on the balance of forces at any given moment. The same was true on land, where Asian empires tended to separate the sphere of warriors and merchants. In Europe, they overlapped. Quote, "All up and down Central Europe, from Tuscany to Flanders, from Brabant to Livonia, merchants not only supplied warriors, as they did all over Europe, they sat in governments that made war and, sometimes, buckled on armour and went into battle themselves. Such places make a long list, not only Florence, Milan, Venice and Genoa, but also Augsburg, Nuremberg, Strasbourg and Zurich, not only Lübeck, Hamburg, Bremen and Danzig, but also Bruges, Kent, Leiden and Cologne. Some of them, Florence, Nuremberg, Siena, Bern and Ulm come to mind, built considerable territorial states." Unquote. The Venetians were only the most famous in this regard. They created a veritable mercantile empire over the course of the 11th century, seizing islands like Crete and Cyprus, and establishing sugar plantations that eventually, anticipating a pattern to become all too familiar in the New World, came to be staffed largely by African slaves. Genoa soon followed suit. One of their most lucrative businesses was raiding and trading along the Black Sea to acquire slaves to sell to the Mamluks in Egypt, or to work mines leased from the Turks. The Genoese Republic was also the inventor of a unique mode of military financing, which might be known as war by subscription, whereby those planning expeditions sold shares to investors in exchange for the rights to an equivalent percentage of the spoils. It was precisely the same galleys with the same merchant adventurers abroad who would eventually pass through the Pillars of Hercules to follow the Atlantic coast to Flanders or the Champagne fairs, carrying cargoes of nutmeg or cayenne, silks and woolen goods, along with the inevitable bills of exchange. It would be instructive, I think, to pause for a moment to think about this term, merchant adventurer. Originally, It just meant a merchant who operated outside his own country. It was around the same time, however, at the height of the fairs of Champagne and the Italian merchant empires, between 1160 and 1172, that the term adventure began to take on its contemporary meaning. The man most responsible for it is the French poet Chrétien de Troyes, becoming author of the most famous Arthurian romances, most famous perhaps for being the first to tell the story of Sir Percival and the Holy Grail. The romances were a new sort of literature featuring a new sort of hero, the knight-errant, a warrior who roamed the world in search of, precisely, adventure. In the contemporary sense of the world, perilous challenges, love, treasure, and renown. Stories of knightly adventure quickly became enormously popular. Chrétien was followed by innumerable imitators, and the central characters in the stories, Arthur and Guinevere, Lancelot, Gawain, Percival, and the rest, became known to everyone, as they are still. This courtly ideal of the gallant knight, the quest, the joust, romance, and adventure, remained central to our image of the Middle Ages. The curious thing is that it bears almost no relation to reality. Nothing remotely like a real knight-errant ever existed. Knights had originally been a term for freelance warriors, drawn from the younger or often bastard sons of the minor nobility. Unable to inherit, many were forced to band together to seek their fortunes. Many became little more than roving bands of thugs in an endless pursuit of plunder, precisely the sort of people who made merchants' lives so dangerous. Culminating in the 12th century, there was a concerted effort to bring this dangerous population under the control of the civil authorities. Not only the code of chivalry, but the tournament, the joust, all these were more than anything else ways of keeping them out of trouble, as it were, in part by setting knights against each other, in part by turning their entire existence into a kind of stylized ritual. The adventure of the lone wandering knight in search of some gallant adventure, on the other hand, seems to have come out of nowhere. This is important since it lies at the very heart of our image of the Middle Ages, and the explanation, I think, is revealing. We have to recall that merchants had begun to achieve unprecedented social and even political power around this time, but that, in dramatic contrast to Islam, where a figure like Sinbad, the successful merchant adventurer, could serve as a fictional exemplar of the perfect life, merchants, unlike warriors, were never seen as paragons of much of anything. It's likely no coincidence that Chrétien was living in Troyes, at the very heartland of the Champagne fairs that had become, in turn, the commercial hub of Western Europe. While he appears to have modelled his vision of Camelot on the elaborate court life under his patron Henri the Liberal, 1152-1181, the court of Champagne, and his wife Marie, daughter of Eleanor of Aquitaine, the real court was staffed by low-born commerçants, who served as sergents of the fairs, leaving most real knights in the role of onlookers, guards, or, at tournaments, entertainers. This is not to say that tournaments did not become a kind of economic focus in their own right. According to one early 20th century medievalist, Amy Kelly, quote, "The biographer of Guillaume le Marchal gives an idea of how this rabble of courtly routiers amused itself on the jousting fields of Western Europe. To the tournaments, occurring in brisk season about twice a month from Pentecost to the Feast of St. John, flocked the young bloods, sometimes 3,000 strong, taking possession of the nearest town. Thither also flocked horse dealers from Lombardy and Spain, from Brittany and the Low Countries, as well as armourers, haberdashers for man and beast, usurers, mimes and storytellers, acrobats, necromancers, and other gentlemen of the lists, the field, the road. Entertainers of every stripe found liberal patronage. There were feasts in upper chambers, and forges rang in the smithies all night long. Brawls with grisly incidents, a cracked skull, a gouged eye, occurred as the betting progressed and the dice flew. To cry up their champions in the field came ladies of fair name, and others of no name at all. The hazards, the concourse, the prizes, keyed men to the pitch of war. The stakes were magnificent, for the victor held his prize, horse and man, for ransom. And for these ransoms, thieves went in gage, or the hapless victim fell into the hands of usurers, giving his men, and in extremity himself, as hostages. fortunes were made and lost on the point of a lance, and many a mother's son failed to ride home. Unquote. So, it was not only that the merchants supplied the materials that made the fairs possible. Since vanquished knights technically owed their lives to the victors, merchants ended up, in their capacity as moneylenders, making good business out of liquidating their assets. Alternatively, a knight might borrow vast sums to outfit himself in magnificence, hoping to impress some fair lady, with handsome dowry, with his victories, others, to take part in the continual whoring and gambling that always surrounded such events. Losers would end up having to sell their armour and horses, and this created the danger that they would go back to being highwaymen, foment pogroms if their creditors were Jews, or, if they had lands, make new fiscal demands on those unfortunate enough to live on them. Others turned to war, which itself tended to drive the creation of new markets. In one of the most dramatic of such incidents, in November 1199, a number of knights at a tournament at the castle of Écry in Champagne, sponsored by Henry's son Theobald, were seized by a great religious passion, abandoned their games, and swore a vow to instead retake the Holy Land. The Crusader army then proceeded to commission the Venetian fleet for transport in exchange for the promise of a 50% share in all the resulting profits. In the end, rather than proceeding to the Holy Land, they ended up sacking the much wealthier Orthodox Christian city of Constantinople after a prolonged and bloody siege. A Flemish count named Baldwin was installed as the Latin Emperor of Constantinople, but attempting to govern a city that had been largely destroyed and stripped of everything of value ensured that he and his barons soon ended up in great financial difficulties. In a gigantic version of what was happening on a small scale in so many tournaments, they were ultimately reduced to stripping the metal off the church roofs and auctioning holy relics to pay back their Venetian creditors. By 1259, Baldwin had sunk to the point of taking out a mortgage on his own son, who was then taken back to Venice as security for a loan. All this does not really answer the question, whence, then, this image of a solitary knight-errant, wandering the forests of a mythical Albion, challenging rivals, confronting ogres, fairies, wizards, and mysterious beasts. The answer should be clear by now. Really, this is just a sublimated, romanticized image of the travelling merchants themselves, men who did, after all, set off on lonely ventures through wilds and forests, whose outcome was anything but certain. And what of the Grail, that mysterious object that all knights-errant were ultimately seeking? Oddly enough, Richard Wagner, composer of the opera Parsifal, first suggested that the Grail was a symbol, inspired by the new forms of finance. Where earlier epic heroes sought after and fought over piles of real, concrete gold and silver, the Nibelung's hoard, these new ones, born of the new commercial economy, pursued purely abstract forms of value. No one, after all, knew precisely what the Grail was. Even the epics disagree. Sometimes it's a plate, sometimes a cup, sometimes a stone. Wolfram von Eschenbach imagined it to be a jewel, knocked from Lucifer's helmet in a battle at the dawn of time. In a way, it doesn't matter. The point is that it's invisible, intangible, but at the same time of infinite, inexhaustible value, containing everything capable of making the wasteland flower, feeding the world, providing spiritual sustenance, and healing wounded babies. Mark Shell even suggested that it would be best conceived as a blank check, the ultimate financial abstraction. What, then, were the Middle Ages? A quote from Plato's Symposium. Each of us is a mere symbolon of a man, the result of bisection, like the flat fish, two out of one, and each of us is constantly searching for his corresponding symbolon. There is one way that Wagner got it wrong. The introduction of financial abstraction was not a sign that Europe was leaving the Middle Ages, but that it was finally, belatedly, entering it. Wagner's not really to blame here. Almost everyone gets this wrong, because the most characteristic medieval institutions and ideas arrived so late in Europe that we tend to mistake them for the first stirrings of modernity. We've already seen this with the bills of exchange, already in use in the East by 700 or 800 AD, but only reaching Europe several centuries later. The independent university, perhaps the quintessential medieval institution, is another case in point. Nalanda was founded in 427 AD, and there were independent institutions of higher learning all over China and the Near West, from Cairo to Constantinople, centuries before the creation of similar institutions in Oxford, Paris, and Bologna. If the Axial Age was the age of materialism, the Middle Ages were above all else the age of transcendence. The collapse of the ancient empires did not, for the most part, lead to the rise of new ones. Instead, once subversive popular religious movements were catapulted into the status of dominant institutions. Slavery declined or disappeared, as did the overall level of violence. As trade picked up, so did the pace of technological innovation. Greater peace brought greater possibilities, not only for the movement of silks and spices, but also of people and ideas. The fact that monks in medieval China could devote themselves to translating ancient treatises in Sanskrit, and that students in the madrasas in medieval Indonesia could debate legal terms in Arabic, is testimony to the profound cosmopolitanism of the age. Our image of the Middle Ages as an age of faith, and hence of blind obedience to authority, is a legacy of the French Enlightenment. Again, it makes sense only if you think of the Middle Ages as something that happened primarily in Europe. Not only was the Far West an unusually violent place by world standards, the Catholic Church was extraordinarily intolerant. It's hard to find many medieval Chinese, Indian, or Islamic parallels, for example, to the burning of witches or the massacre of heretics. More typical was the pattern that prevailed in certain periods of Chinese history, when it was perfectly acceptable for a scholar to dabble in Taoism in his youth, become a Confucian in middle age, and then become a Buddhist on retirement. If there is an essence to medieval thought, it lies not in blind obedience to authority, but rather in a dogged insistence that the values that govern our ordinary daily affairs, particularly those of court and marketplace, are confused, mistaken, illusory, or perverse. True value lay elsewhere, in a domain that cannot be directly perceived, but only approached through study or contemplation. But this, in turn, made the faculties of contemplation and the entire question of knowledge an endless problem. Consider, for example, the Great Conundrum, pondered by Muslim, Christian, and Jewish philosophers alike. What does it mean to simultaneously say that we can only know God through our faculties of reason, but that reason itself partakes of God? Chinese philosophers were struggling with similar conundrums when they asked, "Do we read the classics, or do the classics read us?" Almost all the great intellectual debates of the age turned on this question in one way or another. Is the world created by our minds, or are our minds created by the world? We can see the same tensions within predominant theories of money. Aristotle argued that gold and silver had no intrinsic value in themselves, and that money, therefore, was just a social convention invented by human communities to facilitate exchange. Since it had come about by agreement, therefore, it is within our power to change it or render it useless, if we all decide that that's what we want to do. This position gained little traction in the materialist intellectual environment of the Axial Age, but by the later Middle Ages it had become standard wisdom, and Ghazali was among the first to embrace it. In his own way, he took it even further, insisting that the fact that a gold coin has no intrinsic value is the basis for its value as money, since this very lack of intrinsic value is what allows it to govern, measure, and regulate the value of other things. But at the same time, Ghazali denied that money was a social convention. It was given us by God. And Ghazali was a mystic and a political conservative, so one might argue that he ultimately shied away from the most radical implications of his own ideas. But one could also ask whether in the Middle Ages, arguing that money was an arbitrary social convention was really all that radical a position. After all, when Christian and Chinese thinkers insisted that it was almost always as a way of saying that money is whatever the king or the emperor wished it to be. In that sense, Ghazali's position was perfectly consonant with the Islamic desire to protect the market from political interference by saying that it fell properly under the aegis of religious authorities. The fact that medieval money took such abstract virtual forms, checks, tallies, and paper money, meant that questions like these, what does it mean to say that money is a symbol, cut to the core of the philosophical issues of the day. Nowhere is this so true as in the history of the word symbol itself. Here we encounter some parallels so extraordinary that they can only be described as startling. When Aristotle argued that coins are merely social conventions, the term he used was symbolon, from which our own word symbol is derived. Symbolon was originally the Greek word for tally, an object broken in half to mark a contract or agreement, or marked and broken to record a debt. So our word symbol traces back originally to objects broken to record debt contracts of one sort or another. This is striking enough. What's really remarkable, though, is that the contemporary Chinese word for symbol, fu or fu hao, has almost exactly the same origin. Let's start with the Greek term symbolon. Two friends at dinner might create a symbolon if they took some object, a ring, a knuckle bone, a piece of crockery, and broke it in half. Any time in the future, when either of them had need of the other's help, they could bring their halves as reminders of the friendship. Archaeologists have found hundreds of little broken friendship tablets of this sort in Athens, often made of clay. Later they became ways of sealing a contract, the objects standing in the place of witnesses. The word was also used for tokens of every sort, those given to Athenian jurors entitling them to vote, or tickets for admission to the theatre. It could be used to refer to money, too, but only if that money had no intrinsic value, bronze coins whose value was fixed only by local convention. Used for written documents, a symbolon could also be a passport, contract, commission, or receipt. By extension, it came to mean omen, portent, symptom, or finally, in the now familiar sense, symbol. The path to the latter appears to have been twofold. Aristotle fixed on the fact that a tally could be anything. What the object was didn't matter. All that mattered was that there was a way to break it in half. It's exactly so with language. Words are sounds we use to refer to objects or to ideas, but the relation is arbitrary. There's no particular reason, for example, that English speakers should choose dog to refer to an animal and God to refer to a deity, rather than the other way round. The only reason is social convention, an agreement between all speakers of a language that this sound shall refer to that thing. In this sense, all words were arbitrary tokens of agreement. So, of course, is money. For Aristotle, not only worthless bronze coins that we agree to treat as if they were worth a certain amount, but all money, even gold, is just a symbolon, a social convention. All this came to seem almost commonsensical in the 13th century of Thomas Aquinas, when rulers could change the value of currency simply by issuing a decree. Still, medieval theories of symbols derive less from Aristotle than from the mystery religions of antiquity, where symbolon came to refer to certain cryptic formulae or talismans that only initiates could understand. It thus came to mean a concrete token perceptible to the senses that could only be understood in reference to some hidden reality entirely beyond the domain of sensory experience. The theorist of the symbol, whose work was most widely read and respected in the Middle Ages, was a 6th century Greek Christian mystic whose real name has been lost to history, but who is known by his pseudonym Dionysius the Areopagite. Dionysius took up the notion in this latter sense to confront what was to become the great intellectual problem of the age. How is it possible for humans to have knowledge of God? How can we, whose knowledge is confined to what our senses can perceive of the material universe, have knowledge of a being whose nature is absolutely alien to that material universe? That infinity beyond being, as he puts it, that oneness that is beyond intelligence. It would be impossible, were it not for the fact that God, being all-powerful, can do anything, and therefore, just as he places his own body in the Eucharist, so can he reveal himself to our minds through an endless variety of material shapes. Intriguingly, Dionysius warns us that we cannot begin to understand how symbols work until we rid ourselves of the notion that divine things are likely to be beautiful. Images of luminous angels and celestial chariots are only likely to confuse us, since we will be tempted to imagine that that's what heaven is actually like, and in fact we cannot possibly conceive of what heaven is like. Instead, effective symbols are, like the original symbolon, homely objects selected apparently at random, often ugly, ridiculous things, whose very incongruity reminds us that they are not God, of the fact that God transcends all materiality, even as, in another sense, they are God. But the notion that they are in any sense tokens of agreement between equals is gone entirely. Symbols are gifts, absolute, free, hierarchical gifts, presented by a being so far above us that any thought of reciprocity, debt, or mutual obligation is simply inconceivable. Compare the Greek dictionary above to the following from a Chinese dictionary, giving the meanings of the word bu, to agree with, to tally, the two halves of a tally, evidence, proof of identity, credentials, to fulfill a promise, to keep one's word, to reconcile, the mutual agreement between heaven's appointment and human affairs, a tally, a check, an imperial seal or stamp, a warrant, a commission, credentials, like fitting the two halves of a tally, in exact agreement, a symbol, a sign, and so on. The evolution is almost exactly the same. Like symbola, bu can be tallies, contracts, official seals, warrants, passports, or credentials. As promises, they can embody an agreement, a debt contract, or even a relation of feudal vassalage, since a minor lord agreeing to become another man's vassal would split a tally just as he would if borrowing grain or money. The common feature seems to be a contract between two parties that begin as equal, in which one agrees to become subordinate. Later, as the state became more centralized, we mainly hear about bu presented to officials as a means of conveying order. The official would take the left half with him when posted to the provinces, and when the emperor wished to send him an important command, he would send the right half with the messenger, to make sure that the official knew it was actually the imperial will. We've already seen how paper money seems to have developed from paper versions of such debt contracts, ripped in half and then reunited. For Chinese theorists, of course, Aristotle's argument that money was simply a social convention was hardly radical. It was simply assumed. Money was whatever the emperor established it to be, though even here there was a slight proviso, as evidenced in the entry above, that fu could also refer to the mutual agreement between heaven's appointment and human affairs. Just as officials were appointed by the emperor was ultimately appointed by a higher power, and he could only rule effectively as long as he kept its mandate, which is why propitious omens were called fu, signs that heaven approved of the ruler, just as natural disasters were a sign that he had strayed. Here, Chinese ideas did grow a bit closer to the Christian ones. But Chinese conceptions of the cosmos had one crucial difference. Since there was no emphasis on the absolute gulf between our world and the one beyond it, contractual relations with the gods were by no means out of the question. This was particularly true in medieval Taoism, where monks were ordained through a ceremony called rending the tally, ripping apart a piece of paper that represented a contract with heaven. It was the same with magical talismans, also called fu, which an adept might receive from his master. These were literally tallies. The adept kept one, the other half was said to be retained by the gods. Such talismanic fu took the form of diagrams, said to represent a form of celestial writing, comprehensible only to the gods, which committed them to assist the bearer, often giving the adept the right to call on armies of divine protectors, with whose help he could slay demons, cure the sick, or otherwise attain miraculous powers. But they could also become, like the symbola of Dionysius, objects of contemplation, by which one's mind can ultimately attain some knowledge of the invisible world beyond our own. Many of the most compelling visual symbols to emerge from medieval China trace back to such talismans, the river symbol, or, for that matter, the yin-yang symbol, that seems to have developed out of it. Just looking at a yin-yang symbol, it's easy enough to imagine the left and right, sometimes too called male and female, halves of a tally. A tally does away with the need for witnesses. If the two surfaces agree, then everyone knows that the agreement between the contracting parties exists as well. And this is why Aristotle saw it as a fit metaphor for words. Word A corresponds to concept B because there's a tacit agreement that we shall act as if it does. The striking thing about tallies is that even though they might begin as simple tokens of friendship and solidarity, in almost all the later examples, what the two parties actually agree to create is a relation of inequality, of debt, obligation, subordination to another's orders. This is in turn what makes it possible to use the metaphor for the relation between the material world and the more powerful world that ultimately gives it meaning. The two sides are the same, yet what they create is absolute difference. Hence, for a medieval Christian mystic, as for medieval Chinese magicians, symbols could be literal fragments of heaven, even if, for the first, they provided a language whereby one could have some understanding of beings one could not possibly interact with, while for the second, they provided a way of interacting, even making practical arrangements with beings whose language one could not possibly understand. On one level, this is just another version of the dilemmas that always arise when we try to reimagine the world through debt, that peculiar agreement between two equals that they shall no longer be equals, until such a time as they become equals once again. Still, the problem took on a peculiar piquancy in the Middle Ages, when the economy became, as it were, spiritualized. As gold and silver migrated to holy places, ordinary transactions everywhere came to be carried out primarily on credit. Inevitably, arguments about wealth and markets became arguments about debt and morality, and arguments about debt and morality became arguments about the nature of our place in the universe. As we've seen, the solutions varied considerably. Europe and India saw a return to hierarchy. Society became a ranked order of priests, warriors, merchants, and farmers, or in Christendom, just priests, warriors, and farmers. Debts between the orders were considered threatening because they implied the potential of equality, and they often led to outright violence. In China, by contrast, the principle of debt often became the governing principle of the cosmos. Karmic debts, milk debts, debt contracts between human beings and celestial powers. From the point of view of the authorities, all these led to excess and potentially to vast concentrations of capital that might throw the entire social order out of balance. It was the responsibility of government to intervene constantly to keep the markets running smoothly and equitably, thus avoiding new outbreaks of popular unrest. In the world of Islam, where theologians held that God recreated the entire universe at every instant, market fluctuations were instead seen as merely another manifestation of divine will. The striking thing is that the Confucian condemnation of the merchant and the Islamic celebration of the merchant ultimately led to the same thing, prosperous societies with flourishing markets, but where the elements never came together to create the great merchant banks and industrial firms that were to become the hallmark of modern capitalism. It's especially striking in the case of Islam. Certainly, the Islamic world produced figures who would be hard to describe as anything but capitalists. Large-scale merchants were referred to as shahib al-mal, owners of capital, and legal theorists spoke freely about the creation and expansion of capital funds. At the height of the caliphate, some of these merchants were in possession of millions of dinars and seeking profitable investment. Why did nothing like modern capitalism emerge? I would highlight two factors. Firstly, Islamic merchants appear to have taken their free market ideology seriously. The marketplace did not fall under the direct supervision of the government. Contracts were made between individuals, ideally with a handshake and a glance at heaven, and thus honour and credit became largely indistinguishable. Now this is inevitable. You can't have cutthroat competition where there is no one stopping people from literally cutting one another's throats. Second, Islam also took seriously the principle, later enshrined in classical economic theory, but only unevenly observed in practice, that profits are the reward for risk. Trading enterprises were assumed to be, quite literally, adventures, in which traders exposed themselves to the dangers of storm and shipwreck, savage nomads, forest steppes and deserts, and exotic and unpredictable foreign customs and arbitrary governments. Financial mechanisms designed to avoid these risks were considered impious. Now, this was one of the objections to usury. If one demands a fixed rate of interest, the profits are guaranteed. Similarly, commercial investors were expected to share the risk. This made most of the forms of finance and insurance that were later to develop in Europe impossible. In this sense, the Buddhist monasteries of early medieval China represent the opposite extreme. The inexhaustible treasuries were inexhaustible because, by continually lending out their money at interest, and never otherwise touching the capital, they could guarantee effectively risk-free investments. And that was the entire point. By doing so, Buddhism, unlike Islam, produced something very much like what we now call corporations, entities that, through a charming legal fiction, we imagine to be persons, just like human beings, but immortal, never having to go through all the human untidiness of marriage, reproduction, infirmity, and death. To put it in properly medieval terms, they were very much like angels. Legally, our notion of the corporation is very much a product of the European High Middle Ages. The legal idea of a corporation as a fictive person, persona ficta, a person who, as Maitland, the great British legal historian, put it, is, quote, immortal, who sues and is sued, who holds lands, has a seal of his own, who makes regulations for those natural persons of whom he is composed, unquote, was first established in canon law by Pope Innocent IV in 1250 AD, and one of the first kinds of entities it applied to were monasteries, as also to universities, churches, municipalities, and guilds. The idea of the corporation as an angelic being is not mine, incidentally. I borrowed it from the great medievalist Ernst Kantorowicz, who pointed out that all this was happening right around the same time that Thomas Aquinas was developing the notion that angels were really just the personification of Platonic ideas. According to the teachings of Aquinas, he notes, every angel represented a species. Quote, little wonder, then, that finally the personified collectives of the jurists, which were juristically immortal species, displayed all the features otherwise attributed to angels. The jurists themselves recognized that there was some similarity between their abstractions and the angelic beings. In this respect, it may be said that the political and legal world of thought of the latter Middle Ages began to be populated by immaterial angelic bodies. Large and small, they were invisible, ageless, sempiternal, immortal, and sometimes even ubiquitous. And they were endowed with a corpus intellectuale or mysticum, an intellectual or mystical body, which could stand any comparison with the spiritual bodies of the celestial beings. Unquote. Now, all this is worth emphasizing, because while we're used to assuming there's something natural or inevitable about the existence of corporations, in historical terms, they're actually strange, exotic creatures. No other great tradition came up with anything like it. They are the most peculiarly European addition to that endless proliferation of metaphysical entities so characteristic of the Middle Ages, as well as the most enduring. They have, of course, changed a great deal over time. Medieval corporations owned property, and they often engaged in complex financial arrangements. But in no case were they profit-seeking enterprises in the modern sense. The ones that came closest were, perhaps unsurprisingly, monastic orders, above all the Cistercians, whose monasteries became something like the Chinese Buddhist ones, surrounded by mills and smithies, practicing rationalized commercial agriculture with a workforce of lay brothers, who were effectively wage laborers, spinning and exporting wool. Some even talk about monastic capitalism. Still, the ground was only really prepared for capitalism in the familiar sense of the term when the merchants began to organize themselves into eternal bodies as a way to win monopolies, legal or de facto, and avoid the ordinary risks of trade. An excellent case in point was the Society of Merchant Adventurers, chartered by King Henry IV in London in 1407, who, despite the romantic-sounding name, were mainly in the business of buying up British woollens and selling them in Flanders fairs. They were not a modern joint stock company, but a rather old-fashioned medieval merchant guild. But they provided a structure whereby older, more substantial merchants could simply provide loans to younger ones. and they managed to secure enough of an exclusive control over the woolen trade that substantial profits were pretty much guaranteed. When such companies began to engage in armed ventures overseas, though, a new era of human history might be said to have begun.
And we are going to get to that era in our second hour. We're going to start on Chapter 11, The Age of the Great Capitalist Empires. Now, I was looking for something contrasting to the David Graeber, something to give us another angle on the Age of the Great Capitalist Empires, and I came up with the following. Thanks to Ken McDermott Rowe of History Counts, sadly no longer running, but their previous shows are archived at historycounts.org, or they'll be linked in from this show's webpage. This is an interview from 2009 of author Frank Sanello.
The rise of China as a world power is among the most important historical developments of the last few decades. How China deals with the outside world, in particular the United States and Europe, will likely be affected by its past experiences with foreigners. So in today's program, we take a look at an extremely important episode in Chinese-Western relations, which became known as the Opium Wars. To help us understand the events of this period, we're very fortunate to have with us Frank Sanello, author of The Opium Wars, The Addiction of One Empire and the Corruption of Another. It was published by Sourcebooks and has been translated into both Mandarin and Cantonese. Mr. Sanello is also the author of The Knights Templars, God's Warriors, The Devil's Bankers, published in 2003. Mr. Sanello, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
When and where were the Opium Wars, and who were the antagonists?
They took place in the 19th century. They were two wars fought between Britain and China, both on Chinese territory. The first war was between 1839 and 1842, and the second war was between 1856 and 1860. The primary cause of both wars was China's tragically unsuccessful attempts to stop the British from importing opium from British-controlled India into China. In the late 19th century, opium was turned into heroin and morphine, although opium is not nearly as addictive as heroin and morphine, whose active ingredients are more concentrated.
How did the British decision to import opium into China in the 19th century relate to Britain's trade deficits, and in particular to tea?
In 1674, King Charles II of England got a gift of 2 pounds of strange-smelling black leaves, which turned out to be tea. Within 20 years, England was drinking gallons and gallons and gallons of it, and the Chinese insisted on payment in silver. They would not trade British manufactured goods in exchange for tea. Finally, the British came up with something the Chinese were willing to trade besides silver for tea, and that was opium, because, as any junkie will tell you, it's a seller's market.
So the opium, as I understand it, was grown by the East India Company, British monopoly, in India, and then imported at that time through Canton into China?
Correct.
Now, there was an important cultural conflict that also comes into play in the British-Chinese relations. Could you talk about the unsuccessful 1793 trade mission of Lord Macartney, and particularly reference to the practice of kowtowing? What is kowtowing, and how did that come up in the course of Lord Macartney's mission?
Kowtowing, in the generic meaning, is bowing. But in China, it included, when you met the emperor, you had to bow, genuflect, and then put your forehead on the ground 9 times.
So this struck Lord Macartney and the British the wrong way.
Right. He was willing to do it because Britain was so desperate to open up more ports to trade with China. But, and this is where the farcical elements come in, he brought along with him a giant oil painting of King George III, and he said to the courtiers, I will kowtow, I'll even put my forehead on the marble floor 9 times, if the courtiers do the same to the painting of King George III. And, of course, the Chinese courtiers said, you're nuts. And at that, the emperor dismissed him, and Macartney departed China after spending 80,000 pounds. Which
you also mentioned that the presents that he brought for the Chinese emperor were referred to by the Chinese as, quote, tribute from the Red Barbarians.
McCartney considered them gifts, and the emperor didn't recognize any other monarchs. He was the only ruler in the world, and a non-monarch doesn't give gifts to a monarch. He pays tribute. Plus, when McCartney said, well, we've got all these great manufactured goods for you, like calico and other textiles and farm equipment that we'll trade you for tea, the emperor incorrectly said, there's nothing Britain has that we can't make ourselves, which was not true, as the later battles proved, because the Chinese had 200-year-old weapons against Britain's state-of-the-art weapons.
The opium that came from India, from the East India Company, was sold by private merchants, chiefly British and some Americans and others, through Canton with the cooperation of some Chinese merchants called the Kohong?
Yes, they were the intermediaries.
And this was a very profitable trade for the British and American merchants?
Incredible. The British Exchequer, which is our counterpart of the Treasury Department and the IRS, was addicted to the revenues produced by the tax on opium because they slapped 100% tax on all the money the British made from selling opium. But the British merchants still made out like bandits because they put a 400% markup on the cost of actually producing or growing the opium. So everybody made money except the Chinese.
How pervasive was opium addiction in China in the early 19th century?
This is a shocking statistic. 90%, it's estimated, of the emperor's court and 90% of his military, including his generals, were users of opium. And at the time of the first opium war in 1832, it was estimated that 14 million Chinese were full-blown addicts. It devastated Chinese society much the same way, only worse than the crack epidemic did in the inner city here in the 80s and 90s, and what methamphetamine, crystal meth, is doing to the U.S. today. Society collapsed. People stopped working. China was a country of scholars. All the government officials, in order to get promoted, the way they got promoted was taking Chinese literature tests. They didn't take, bureaucrat tests. And it was a major scandal that all these students were dropping out of school because they were stoned out of their mind on a heroin substitute.
You cite a French study that found that a person lived only about 6 years after becoming an opium addict.
Opium does do major damage to your internal organs, and it eventually blows up your liver.
Was opium illegal in Britain at that time?
No. It was allowed. The reason the British weren't nearly so affected is that it was sold in a form called laudanum, which was red wine with just a teeny little bit of opium in it, but it was enough to get people addicted anyway, but not nearly as bad as smoking it. One of the few British politicians who opposed the opium trade was the future Prime Minister William Gladstone, because his poor sister got addicted to laudanum, liquid opium, and she died of it.
Well, could you talk about the efforts made by China, in particular China's High Commissioner Lin, in 1839 to suppress opium use and trafficking?
Commissioner Lin was one of the few incorruptible officials in China, and the emperor sent him to Canton to tell the British to stop importing opium, and they ignored him because they were making a 400% profit. And so Lin did the equivalent of America's Boston Tea Party, and he had Chinese board British ships that had opium, and they threw the opium overboard just the way the American colonials overthrew British tea overboard because they didn't like the competition. And he also burned a lot of it. And the way the British reacted was by invading the country twice.
You describe the two wars as a single war with a 14-year intermission. And you also say that it was essentially a war of the medieval versus the modern.